the Board of Psychological Examiners. The time now is 7:47 on April 3rd, 2020, and I call the meeting to order. Item number two, roll call. Ms. Poe, would you please call the roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Flowers?
Present.
Dr. Bohansky?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Gill?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Great, thank you. Item number three on the agenda, please note that the time stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one item and proceed to a timed item and then return to a former item. In regards to board surveys, if you would like, we encourage anyone who is a guest today to fill out a survey. And in order to do that, if you want a survey form, please contact our staff and they'd be happy to provide that to you. And I want to recognize all the board members for your hard work. Each member spends many hours preparing for our meetings, and we greatly appreciate it. And this also includes a big thank you and acknowledgement to our board staff and our attorney, Jean Galvin. We really appreciate your time, and I know this is a very challenging time for our country and probably for ourselves and our families, so even a bigger thank you for putting your time and effort into this board meeting. Item number four, council update. Ms. Galvin, do you have any updates for us?
Just briefly, Ms. Shreve, with respect to the matter involving Dr. Gray, you'll remember that an anonymous complaint was filed with the board, and it was at the level of the CSC. Those proceedings did not conclude, as Dr. Gray filed a special action challenging the board's authority to process and adjudicate anonymous complaints. It went to the Superior Court, and that court found in favor of the board and found that the board could process and hear anonymous complaints. Dr. Gray then appealed to the Court of Appeals, and we received that decision last week. That decision was also in favor of the board, finding that the board does have the authority to hear anonymous complaints. And I have confirmed with Dr. Gray's attorney that he is not appealing the decision to the Supreme Court, so the matter will be placed on a future agenda of the CSC. And then Dr. Denbor, I believe I updated you last meeting, but just to affirm, Dr. Denbor had challenged the board's application of ARS 32-2081C related to court-appointed services and whether that statute applied to services that occurred before July 1st, 2015, or if the appointment occurred before July 1st, 2015. The Superior Court in that matter also found in favor of the board, and we also received a decision from the Court of Appeals within the last couple of weeks that found in favor of the board and its application of 32-2081C. I have confirmed with Dr. Denbor's counsel that he will file an appeal with the Supreme Court, so we will be handling that in the upcoming months. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin, and thank you for representing us. We do appreciate that. Item number five is the consent item agenda. Is there any recusals from the board members on any consent items? Hearing none, a board member may request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion. Is there any request to do that? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the consent item agenda? Items on the agenda?
So moved.
We got a motion. Is there a second?
I second.
A second by Dr. Flowers. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none. We will move to item number six. starts at 8 o'clock. So let's go ahead. We have a few minutes. Let's move to item number...
Ms. Shreve, if I may, this is Ms. Pakkinen. If we have Dr. Dr. O'Connell or Dr. Walsh on the line, we may want to move up their items and hear them now.
Sure, let's do that. What item number? I'm going to put my item number. Is
11 is Dr. Walsh, and 12 is Dr. O'Connell.
Let's do 11. This is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding renewal of application submitted by Dr. Walsh. Ms. Poe, would you like to provide us an update on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the board, on March 18th, 2020, the board office received Dr. Walsh's psychologist application for license renewal submitted via the online e-licensing portal. Board staff noted that Dr. Walsh answered yes to question number 9 of the application. This question relates to investigations by a regulatory agency or licensing board. Dr. Walsh included a detailed explanation as well as copies of official documents from the California Board of Psychology regarding the matter. The matter was heard by that board and it was dismissed without formal investigation or disciplinary action. Dr. Walsh's renewal has not been processed and board staff is requesting direction from the board. All documentation has been provided for your review. And I do believe Dr. Walsh is on the line. I'm not sure if he's wanting to make a statement or just available for board member questions, but that concludes my summary of the case.
Thank you. Are there any questions that the board would like to ask Dr. Walsh? All right, hearing none, is there any discussion or motions from the board regarding this situation? It appears as though California found, you know, no credence to move forward with the complaint and it was dropped.
Yes, Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to make a motion that his request for extended license or license renewal will be approved and the board take no further action in the matter.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor? Aye.
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 And any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Let's move on to item 12, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding Catherine O'Connell, to include potential findings of non-compliance with the 2015-2017 continuing education requirements. Ms. Poe, would you like to brief us?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. The Continuing Education Committee recently completed the 2015-2017 renewal cycle continuing education CE audit. This agenda item is related to the fact that Dr. Catherine O'Connell has not responded to the committee's request regarding deficiencies found in the CE documentation she submitted. Therefore, Dr. O'Connell may not have met the CE requirements for her license renewal, which was processed during the 2015-2017 cycle. Board staff did receive email from Dr. O'Connell this week after she received notice of this meeting, but we've not received the CE material requested. Board staff is requesting direction from the board on how to proceed and if any action should be taken. Dr. O'Connell is on the line. I believe she may want to make a statement. All documentation has been provided for your review, and this concludes my summary of this case.
Thank you. So just so I, just to confirm, the doctor has not provided you with the documentation of the missing credits. Is that correct?
That is correct. She submitted the initial CE documentation, but when the deficiency letter was sent out, she did not respond to that letter.
Okay, thank you. Dr. O'Connell, you are on the line. Did you want to make a brief statement?
Yes, I did not receive the letter of the deficiency, which is why I didn't respond. I just now figured out this week what the, actually yesterday, what the issue was when there was one of my CE certificates that I forgot to include in the audit. It's listed, but for management of concussion for mild traumatic brain injury for 6 hours, but I didn't include the certificate, which I have here now. And I'm sorry I didn't respond, but like I say, I didn't get that letter.
All right, did you notify the staff that you didn't get that letter before this meeting?
No, I didn't even know until last night. I didn't even know that there was a letter sent.
Okay, so you'll be able to provide the documentation now?
I can. I can either text it to someone or email it to you.
All right. Are there any other questions from the board members for the doctor? And thank you, Dr. Fulton.
This is Ramona.
Dr. Malat?
Dr. Shreve? Yeah. I have a question from Ms. O'Connell, Dr. O'Connell. In terms of, you included a course that was completed in 2015 April, which was in the prior licensing cycle. What we have been asking board members, since you're counting that course, you have to submit the CEs from the previous cycle so the board can, so the committee can make a determination that that specific course was not used for the CE credit for the previous cycle. Will you be able to submit that documentation as well?
The certificate that I forgot to include was completed in August of 2018, so it could not have been used for the previous cycle.
The issue in domestic violence, intimate partner sexual abuse was completed on 4/27/2015. And if you, our letter would state, and we will ask board staff to send an email copy of the letter to you. So we would need documentation, or you can do a new domestic violence, sexual abuse, you have to meet that criteria. And the last one, excuse me, that we did not receive was a certificate of attendance for intimate partner sexual abuse, which you did say you took in August 2008, and it is 2 credits for domestic violence, and we would need that certificate as well. The second question I have for you, Dr. O'Connell, is has your address changed by any chance in the last 4 months?
No, the address hasn't changed. I have, for the most part, retired, but so I'm not going into the office, but I'm still getting mail there, and I don't know why I didn't get that one letter of deficiency. I don't know whether there was someone working in the office who thought that because I wasn't coming into the office very much that I didn't need it or whatever. I have no idea. But I'm still receiving my mail at the same place.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. O'Connell? All right, thank you. Yeah. Hearing none, this is the time for
let me
us
just
to
clarify. Yeah, let me just clarify what you need from me. You need the
Dr. O'Connell, we will send you the letter.
Yes.
We don't, you know, it's better that you have it in writing rather than doing this.
Right, Dr. O'Connell,
Okay.
Our staff will clarify with you through a letter or afterwards. They will contact you. So in regards to this matter, until she provides the documentation, there is a concern of the lack of the credit. You know, my thoughts is if she can provide documentation of the continuation credit that's missing, then there's no issue. If this documentation cannot be produced, then there is a concern that the requirements were not met. And in that case, maybe we would open a complaint.
Okay. Then, and I can provide.
Ma'am, this is a time for the board to discuss. So, board members, how would you like to proceed?
Can I ask a question? This is Dr. Gill.
Dr.
Gill, can I ask a question? Yes. The letter that was sent out to Dr. O'Connell, was a return receipt requested?
Dr. Gill and Chairman Shreve, no. We sent out the deficiency letters regular mail. It was never returned to the board office, so we, you know, I have no knowledge of where it went if she didn't receive it, because the address was correct on the letter and it was not returned to the board.
Okay.
Right. And so if she provides the documentation, which it sounds like that she has, then there's not an issue. If there's no documentation to be provided, then that is where a decision point would be made with the board, because then she's out of compliance.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I think it'd be a good idea to give her until, well, I guess 30 days, and then we'll have another board meeting, and it can be reviewed again. So it could be tabled.
All right.
The matter could be tabled until the next board meeting, by which time,
all right,
you know, she'll need to give us that documentation, and we'll review it and see if further action's needed.
All right. Is that the consensus of the board? And Ms. Galvin, do I need a vote on that, or can we just table if that's the consensus?
If that's the consensus, you can just table.
Okay, so
yeah,
is that
I'm
the consensus of the board?
Yeah,
I would agree with Dr. Flowers. Is there anyone that does not agree with that? All right, hearing none, then we will table this item. Dr. O'Connell, you'll have the 30 days or whatever. The staff will get hold of you in providing that documentation. And if it's not provided, then the item would be placed on the next agenda. All right,
okay.
Moving forward.
Madam Chair.
Email to me because the office is closed right now.
All right, so can you please contact if you would take the initiative to contact the staff and then give them the exact contact information that for you, that would be great. All right, we're going to move to item number. Okay, we're going to move to item number 6. And discussion, consideration, and possible action whether to open a complaint for potential unlawful practice regarding Carol Nandolfo. One second, please. It is now 8:04. And I'd like to remind, I'm getting an echo on my phone. I don't know. So if everyone has their lines on mute, that would. As a reminder, Lynn Evans is our independent legal advisor for this matter. She is present. Also, I'd like to remind the board members that we previously denied a requested stay concerning this decision, and therefore we're just deciding together whether to move forward with the opening complaint. Executive Director, do you have a summary?
Only that. Mr. Riches, representing Dr. Gandolfo, is present, and he would like to make a statement relative to this agenda item. And again, you didn't discuss previously the merits of this matter, the facts of this matter. You only made the determination to deny the request for the stay of the determination whether to open the complaint, and the materials that you've been supplied constitute those that were submitted by Dr. Gandolfo when she applied for her license.
Chairperson Shreve, this is, yes, Larry Cohen. I'm on the phone. I'm on the phone as her counsel as well.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to, or would Mr. Ritchie like to make some statements?
Madam Chair, this is John Riches. I do have a brief statement.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you to the chairperson, to the members of the board. My name is John Riches, and I represent Carol Gandolfo in this matter. I think, like all of us, I've been giving a lot of thought to what we can do during this enormous time of crisis, and it occurred to me that this board is uniquely suited to do something about the crisis that's facing all of us. I pulled some very preliminary numbers, and it's pretty clear that the services that licensees of this board provide are in very high demand. Domestic violence in Seattle, where this crisis is particularly acute, is up 21%. Those numbers follow internationally, where it's up 36% in France. Calls to the child abuse hotline in the United States are up 23%. Purchase of alcohol is up 50%. and the CDC just released guidelines on anxiety and stress. It seems to me that at a time when mental health services are going to be in greater demand than perhaps they've ever been, we should be looking at ways to expand those services to all Arizonans and not restrict them. I think there are three primary points the board should consider in deciding what to do on the agenda item before you. The first, and perhaps the most important, is that Dr. Gandolfo has not practiced psychology without a license. She is not currently practicing psychology without a license. Second, opening a complaint would not serve the purpose of this board's licensing authority. And third, Dr. Gandolfo is licensed in the state of Arizona as a marriage and family therapist, so it would be both pointless and moot to open an investigation. The very unlikely but worst possible result would be for the board to order Dr. Gandolfo to cease and desist activities she is already licensed and authorized to provide. First, Dr. Gandolfo has not practiced psychology without a license, and she is not currently practicing psychology without a license. To the extent that this entire agenda item is predicated on a single line on a website, there is plain evidence from the city of Sedona and its police and fire departments that at no point in Dr. Gandolfo's volunteer services with those departments did she ever engage in the practice of psychology. Second, I don't think it should be lost that no one on this board, nor anyone anywhere else, has questioned Dr. Gandolfo's competence or professionalism. She has been a licensed psychologist in the state of California for nearly two decades. She has been a licensed marriage and family therapist in the state of California for 20 years. And she has been a licensed marriage and family counselor in this state since the beginning of the year. I think it's both plain and obvious that Dr. Gandolfo is an experienced professional in multiple fields. What public health and safety benefit could possibly be served by opening a complaint against a professional that no one has ever complained about? Finally, Dr. Gandolfo is a licensed marriage and family therapist in the state of Arizona. She applied for licensure with the Board of Behavioral Health, which approved her license as a marriage and family therapist under the very same law that this board rejected her application for licensure. This is, of course, a separate issue than the one before you today, but I think it is very fair to ask why the laws of this state are not being fairly and uniformly applied across Title 32 licensing boards, including this board. Setting that aside, Dr. Gandolfo is licensed in this state to provide a range of behavioral health services. If this investigation were opened, we believe the evidence is unequivocal that the board would not find Dr. Gandolfo as engaged in the unlawful practice of psychology. But in the exceedingly unlikely event that the board did make that finding, what would be that remedy? What would be the board's remedy? A cease and desist order to order Dr. Gandolfo to either, one, stop engaging in activities she is not engaging in, or two, stop activities she is already authorized to perform under a different license. Such an exercise would be futile, it would be moot, and it would be a waste of the resources of this board, of Dr. Gandolfo, and of the state of Arizona. So rather than perform that exercise, I think there is another path. Dr. Gandolfo would agree to stipulate that she is and will only engage in marriage and family counselor services unless and until her license is granted by this board. In light of the enormous and unprecedented crisis sweeping this country and this state, Arizona is now more than ever in need of mental health services. Respectfully, we should all be focused on ways to safely expand those services, not limit them. I'm happy to answer any questions from the board.
All right, thank you. And before we start the questions from the board, I'd just like to, I believe, Dr. Gill, you are recusing from this item. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so he will not be participating in any of this discussion at all, so I just wanted to make that clear for the record. Board members, do you have any questions? Mr. Cohen, first, did you have a comment?
I do not. Thank you for the opportunity, Chairperson Shrews.
All right, thank you. So are there any questions from the board for Dr. Gangofsko's attorneys?
Madam Chair, I'm wanting some clarification.
Dr. Flowers?
Is the purpose of today's discussion to decide if we should open a complaint?
That is correct. So it's not, yes, it's just strictly to whether a complaint should be opened.
Okay, so I don't know that we can ask for testimony or whatever of Dr. Gandolfo or those kind of things.
This is as Assistant Attorney General. This would not be a time for asking for testimony or additional information. It is just whether or not to open a complaint.
Okay, so really asking the attorney questions might be premature.
I think it is a little premature at this point. Again, the question before the board is whether or not to just open a complaint and only decide on that issue alone. And there may be a need for additional information for the board staff to gather to present at a later meeting if a complaint is open. But, yeah, anything further beyond the issue of opening the complaint would go beyond what's listed on the agenda.
Okay, so then, you know, perhaps it's up to the chair, of course. Could you just have more discussion of the issue then?
Dr. Flowers, we will do that. I'd like to ask though first and to turn Ms. Galvin in this particular case is working in the capacity as a prosecutor. She's not representing us. Ms. Evans is. Ms. Galvin, did you have any comments regarding this this case?
I do not. Oh, I do not take any position on this question.
Okay, I just wanted to give you that opportunity too.
Thank you.
All right, so board members, the question then I get is whether we are going to open a complaint. And in essence, the situation was there. You know, it was brought to our attention that the doctor is a member of the critical incident team for Sedona Fire. What we don't know as to what capacity or what she was doing, but that was brought to our attention. Are there any thoughts on how to proceed from the board members?
This is Dr. Malott. Could I make a comment?
Please, yes.
Yeah. As I look at Dr. Gandolfo's materials, especially the membership on the board, and all of the different materials we were provided, it does not look like, I mean, when you serve on a board, you serve for various reasons. And as I look at that, you have a member on the same board who, is a senior executive, so it has a different kind of, not a psychologist or counselor or anything. You have an administrator. You have people with different backgrounds coming on this board who describe their background. When you serve on a board, you're serving more in an advisory capacity, and you bring your background and your training and the knowledge you have. No way is the word psychologist used. So I don't know, unless my board members can convince me otherwise, I don't see how this description, she's stating facts. Board certified founding fellow, you know, these are things that she has on her resume. But anyway, so that's, and I'm speaking specifically on this board and serving on the critical incident team. I think a question I would have, do you have to be a psychologist to serve on that critical incident team, or are there different people who serve on it to provide advice? I mean, I'm just curious, though. Those are my initial thoughts.
Thank you. For me, it's about consistency. Are we based on the information we have, are we being consistent with how we're handling it? And I think, Dr. Malott, those are some good points. Any other comments or thoughts from board members?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I mean, there are some things, I'd like to have clarified, and I think Dr. Gandolfo would need to comment, which may not be appropriate today, but some of these things might be totally not her fault. But for example, there was a news article in July 22nd, 2019, by it looks like Susan Milligan, and within it, it talks about Dr. Gandolfo's request to become licensed in 2007, and that was denied. And then the last paragraph regarding her, it says And none of that was good enough for the licensing authorities in Arizona, who gave varying, and she says sometimes unsubstantiated reasons for not giving her license to practice clinical psychology in Grand Canyon State. So Gandolfo has had to limit her Arizona business to California clients, except for non-counseling work she does. So I would need some clarification on that. You know, I don't think Dr. Gandolfo wrote the article. Maybe the person who wrote it just said some things without understanding what was meant. For example, not unusual for people to think that psychologists are psychiatrists. We're not. But I've seen articles where psychologists are described as psychiatrists. That's not necessarily the fault of the psychologist. So with this one, I'd want to hear from her on that and see if indeed, she is seeing, has given clinical psychology services to people in Arizona who happen to be from California. That's a different kind of an issue, but we don't know. And then the board activity that she mentioned does talk about 20 years of experience working with developmental disabilities, major mental illness, and other things. Well, domestic violence, family therapy. And I guess the question, again, that would be for Dr. Gandolfo to answer is, where exactly is that experience? What were you doing and where? Those are the two key questions, I think, that define this. And anyway, those are my comments.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers. Any other thoughts or comments? Hearing none, is there a motion on? Oh, Dr. Meyer.
Well, one second. Dr. Flowers raises.
Wait, Dr.
Could we ask our attorney if we can at least ask a question, because that would determine.
I think Ms. Evans said we could not, but Ms. Evans, could you clarify again whether the board can ask a question of the doctor or her attorneys?
Yes. My advice at this point is, this is Lynette Evans, Assistant Attorney General. I think that would go, again, beyond the scope of the item that was listed on the agenda today. The board has a need for additional information. We may need to set that out, or perhaps the complaint process could be the process by which the board could gather, staff could gather that additional information and bring it back to the board for consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. Dr. Davies, did you have a comment?
Dr. Meyer?
Oh, Dr. Meyer, I'm sorry. Dr. Meyer?
Yeah, so the component that I'm focused on is the mental health representative on a critical incident team for the Sedona Fire Department. It says that she was providing support to first responders, and it's titled a mental health representative. So that... And looks like she's been doing it since 2011. So whether that falls under the psychology board or the behavioral health board, there is a practice without a license, it seems like to me, in Arizona. That she's now licensed as a marriage and family therapist, that just happened in January of 2020. So that doesn't negate her practice over the past 9 years. And that's been a comment in a couple of the responses from the attorney, is that, well, if she gets her psychology license, then this is all moot, but it's not. I mean, there's been a decade of practice without a license, and that's the concern. So it seems that there have been some form of mental health services provided in Arizona without a license. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. I think to be consistent, in the past, when an issue has been brought up like this, we have just opened the complaint and looked at it. And if it's not relevant, if they're not practicing, then it's dropped. If they are, we move forward. Are there any thoughts or is there any motions from the board?
Yes. Excuse me, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a motion to the complaint. Be started in regards to this matter, in regards to possible title violation.
All right. And we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Yes. All in favor?
No. One second. I do have a question. I wanted to respond to Dr. Meyer's point. And not specifically to his point, you know, I'm curious as to what constitutes the requirements. You know, oftentimes I serve as an education representative on many boards because of my title, my job title, but I'm not a K-12 educator. That doesn't mean I'm practicing outside of my scope. So I'm just trying to, you know, we often, so I'm curious as to what the qualifications are to serve on this, you know, critical incident stress management team or critical incident team, you know, does it have specific qualifications or do they pick just different people to be on that team? I mean, that's the question. In the past, and so the second point I want to make is in the past when we have seen materials, or we've seen things that we are concerned about, and I don't know, I wish we could ask Ms. Galvin because we've got a long history of people who we've been concerned. We tend to get a lot of materials back. You know, we say, hey, we've noticed that you're doing this. They send us all these materials, and then you make a determination, you know. Have you always opened a board complaint? That's my question, because we've had many, many such, putting aside what we know about Dr. Gandalf and the other, but just if this was any person,
Dr. Malott, I believe the only ones I can recall us dealing with are the ones that came to the attention of the board or that were anonymously brought to the board or someone brought to the board. We opened a complaint. Yeah. And we looked at it, and if it, you know, if it was nothing, it was dropped. If it appeared, if there was something to move forward. But I think they all went through a complaint process if they felt like there was enough concern. If someone sees it differently, then please, you know, mention that.
Okay.
But is there any other discussion? Because we have a motion. Is there any other discussion? We have a motion and a second.
I would ask for a roll call vote, please.
All right, thank you. Could we please have a roll call vote?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Is that
Ms. Shreve?
Thank you, Ms. Poe. Yes.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes.
Dr. Bohansky?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
No.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Malott?
I'm going to abstain.
We have 6 votes of yes. Motion carries.
Thank you. All right, let's move. We have a few minutes before our next timed item. Can we move to item number 9, discussion consideration and possible action regarding request to terminate probation on case 1811 for Dr. Michael Johnson? Can we have a brief summary of this, please, Ms. Michelson?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. In January of 2019, Dr. Johnson entered into a consent agreement in order for probation, supervision, and continuing education with regards to case number 18-11, which included the following stipulations. Probation for a minimum of 12 months. While on probation, meet with a practice monitor for a total of 4 hours per month. Complete 18 hours of continuing education. And at the end of 1 year, Dr. Johnson may petition the board and request termination from probation. On March 16th, the board office received his request to terminate probation. In staff's review of the information, he completed the required 18 hours of continuing education and engaged in supervision with Dr. Janet Messler for approximately 1 year. On March 24th, the board office received Dr. Messler's final quarterly report in which she indicated that she had no concerns at this time and recommended that his license to practice be fully reinstated. I do believe Dr. Johnson is present on the phone if the members have any questions for him. This concludes my summary of the matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there any questions for the dossier from the board members? Hearing none, is there any discussion regarding this matter? It appears the practice monitor feels that the probation was successfully completed. Any comments from the board, or is there a motion from the board?
This is Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I make a motion that the request to terminate probation for case 18-11 be approved.
Thank you. Is there a second?
And that would include restore his license to full, active, unrestricted.
Yes.
Thank you. And is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second, I believe, from Dr. Gill. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. We still got just a few minutes. Executive Director, do you think there's any quick items we can go through?
Yes, Madam Chair, I can provide a relatively brief update for item 16, the item specific to legislation.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, as I have supplied to you reports via email, the continuation bill did pass, and so we successfully ensured the continuation of the agency through June 30th of 2028. Unfortunately, the House Bill 2224, in which we were very invested, that bill is essentially suspended. It was very close to passing through the Senate, the second chamber, and transmittal to the governor when the legislature elected to recess. The recess is has announced that they announced that the recess was intended to be for 3 weeks, and they would resume on April 13th. That remains unclear whether that is indeed going to happen or possibly that date be pushed out into the future. I'm monitoring the situation. Of course, if the legislature decides to not reconvene, to return from recess, then the opportunity to see this bill pass in this session is over, and we need to make an attempt, presumably in the next session. I think the situation is complicated in that this isn't the only bill, of course, that didn't make it across the finish line. So legislators are under pressure from stakeholders and constituents to finish their work. And it's an election year, so they're eager to begin campaigning activities in the summer and the fall. So we will just have to wait and see what happens. And at some point, we may need to discuss our strategy once we have clarity of the legislature's future activities in this year.
All right. Thank you for that update. Are there any questions from the board for our executive director?
Dr. Bob.
All right, hearing none, thank you. Yes, Dr. Bob.
One of the critical pieces in this legislation was the patch for what amounts to several hundred Argosy students who would be denied licensure. My question is, the recent activity of our last board meeting with the other executive orders provide an opportunity or pathway for this large number of folks to obtain temporary and or permanent licensure in the state? Is this bill the only shot they have or is there a way we can craft some of these executive orders in such a way to provide that relief?
Well, that's going to be critical.
Madam Chair, Dr. Bohansky, we can certainly agendize that matter at an upcoming meeting to try to achieve what it is that you're describing.
And I would encourage that. It's part of our legislative issues, and the significance here is not one person, but this is dozens of potential psychologists who are in training in their postdoctoral year, in their internship year, or have already completed their internship year, and essentially are on hold. And this board made a commitment to try to fix it. The health committees made commitments to try to fix it. We have the legislation. It's sitting there. Right now, unfortunately, with the climate of what's going on, everything's on hold. But it should also be clear, or it seems to me to be clear, that when we want to move something, or when the governor wants to move something, we have an order that provides for that. So I sure as all heck like us to keep this in the forefront on our agendas so that we, in fact, can respond to this need. And as noted in earlier discussion in this meeting, there is a critical need, and we should not be standing in the way.
Madam Chair, if I may, Dr. Bohansky, perhaps when we get to agenda item number 14, Ms. Galvin can weigh in relative to whether the language of that agenda item effectively opens the door or permits this board to have the discussion that that you're describing.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, the time now is 8:34, and we're going to move on to agenda item 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to initial case reviews. I'd like to remind the board members that the purpose of the initial review is for the board to determine whether there may be a violation of rule or statute. The board is not conducting an informal interview today. The board may vote to go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to Arizona Revised Statute 38431.03A2 or review confidential records and or ARS 38431.03A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. Individuals who wish to speak must complete a request to speak form or let us know, I guess, on the phone, and the board will receive that information. You will be given an opportunity to address the board. The first complaint is number 2020, Dr. Connie Fiburn. Dr. Flowers, you are the lead on that. Is there anyone on the board first that is going to be recusing from this case? All right, just want to confirm that. Dr. Flowers, would you like to provide an overview?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. By way of background, on November 27th, 2012, there was a court order which stated that both parents must be in agreement regarding the son's medical treatment. RC, the complainant, said that at a court hearing on October the 28th, 2019, he found out that Dr. Pyburn had met with her son and with his father for 3 therapy sessions. Dr. Pyburn gave the son advice regarding his behavior. Dr. Pyburn did not obtain permission from RC to treat her son, and Dr. Pyburn was not court-appointed in this case. In response, the licensee, Dr. Pyburn, said that RC is involved in a legal dispute with the father, over the custody of the son. Dr. Pyburn said that she was not treating or giving therapy to the son. The son participated as a collateral to father's therapy for 2 sessions, August 8th and August 16th of 2019. Dr. Pyburn said that she did not need to obtain RC's consent for the son to participate in 2 play therapy sessions as a collateral to father's therapy. The father received services from Dr. Pyburn because he wanted to be a better parent. Dr. Pyburn said that the record shows that Dr. Pyburn made father aware that he was a client and that the son only was in two sessions as collateral to the father's treatment. Dr. Pyburn did not need RC's informed consent for the son's collateral participation because she did not provide any therapeutic care to the father, to the son. Father asked Dr. Pyburn to testify at a family court hearing, and on October 28, 2019, she did so. At the February 19, 2020 Complaint Screening Committee, the committee voted to forward the complaint to the board for possible violations of ARS 32-2061-16H, failing or refusing to maintain adequate business records, financial or professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided to a client or patient, and then ARS, the same one, 2061-16, and then O for possibly providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. And, ARS 32-2061-16DD for possibly violating an ethical standard adopted by the board as it pertains to Section 3.10, informed consent, of the APA Ethical Principles of Psychologists and Code of Conduct. Subsequently, on March 27th, a board staff member called the father. The father said that RC made allegations in custody proceedings that the son was afraid of him. The father didn't understand this because he thought that he and his son had a good relationship, and so the father decided to seek services because he wanted to be a better person and parent. He did not seek services for his son. The father asked Dr. Pyburn if she could bring the son in so she could observe their interactions and then provide father with feedback. When they were headed to the first session together, the father told son that father was going to see one of his friends talk. And that there'd be toys for the son to play with while they talked. When they arrived at the office, Dr. Pyburn said hello or something similar, but they never had a conversation about why he was present. During one of the sessions the son attended, they were wrestling on the couch and playing around. Son randomly said that he was going to tell RC that father was choking him. Father asked son why he would tell RC something that wasn't true, to which the son replied that it made mama happy. Dr. Pyburn asked the son why he would say that. This is the only thing that Dr. Pyburn ever said to the son directly. And then the father proceeded to tell the son the importance of being honest and not lying. During the call, the board staff read portions of the consent form where Dr. Pyburn wrote, father agreed that he was client and child can attend as collateral 1 to 3 times and to inform the therapist of the dad's parenting skills. The father said that he remembered seeing this statement on the form that he signed. And then on March 27th, the board office received additional 10 pages from Dr. Pyburn's attorney regarding treatment sessions from intake sessions on July 22nd, 2019, and July 25th, 2019, with the father to demonstrate that it was made clear that she would not be providing therapy to the son and that she did not need RC's informed consent to bring son to the father's treatment as a collateral. The documentation says that Dr. Pyburn appropriately documented the son was collateral and that additionally Dr. Pyburn consulted with a standard of care expert, Dr. Adler Tapia, who opined in her report that Dr. Pyburn did not breach any standard of care. Dr. Pyburn's response concluded that there's no evidence to support a violation of statutes in this matter. This concludes my summary of the complaint.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers. Do we have any requests to speak?
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Michelson. I do believe that the complainant, RC, is on the phone and would like to address the board. And we also do have Dr. Pyburn and her attorney on the phone as well.
Great. RC, thank you for being here today. Would you like to make a brief statement?
Sure. Thank you very much. Good morning to everybody. As Dr. Flowers stated, he did give a very good update or a summary of the situation. I do want to state that as of today, I do have full physical custody of my son and full decision-making of our son. Father only has 5 hours of supervised parenting time each week. While Dr. Piper may have stated that she did not violate any of the psychological or make any violations, however, from the documentation that I received, any exhibits, and during the temporary orders hearing on October 28th, 2019, it did seem like Dr. Pyburn did give my son some advice. Additionally, there was a communication from Dr. Pyburn to father that states Antonio said he was going to tell his mom you choked him when you two were playing. I asked why, and he said it makes her happy. You chastised him for lying and told him not to tell her that. I said it's not okay to lie, but not to restrict what he told his mom. So from my perspective and the court's perspective, it seemed like Dr. Piper did in fact provide some advice to my, at the time, 7-year-old child. Additionally, I don't believe that a 7-year-old has the ability to be collateral to his adult parents. And I don't think any advice should be given to a minor without the parent's consent and without following the appropriate court orders in place. At the time, there was a court order in place that stated that parenting decisions shall be required for major issues in raising the child and in meeting ongoing needs. When they arise, each parent shall give good faith consideration to the views of the other and put forth the efforts to reach a consensus decision. If a decision involves medical or schooling issues, the parties may further elect to seek input from treating physicians or educators. Both parents shall be provided with such input. If they cannot agree, neither parent shall make unilateral decisions for major decisions. If my son was seen by Dr. Pyburn during the summer of 2019, why did I find out about it on October of 2019? And why did it take me to go to court and raise these temporary issues for me to find out that my son was seeing a professional with father? That's all I have to say. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you very much for those comments. Are there any questions for RC from the committee members? Sorry about that. Hearing none. Thank you, RC, for participating. We will now have a discussion. Is Dr. Flyburn, are you on the phone?
Yes. Chair Shreve, this is Flynn Carey, counsel for Dr. Pyburn. I believe she's also present, but I do have some comments to make.
Yes, please go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Chair Shreve, members of the board. First of all, I want to clarify and correct RC's statement. Father confirmed during his interview, I'm assuming with Ms. Michelson, that the advice about the child not lying was given to the father. That has been our position from the beginning. At no time did Dr. Pyburn give the child advice. And RC's position about the documentation is simply not accurate about that. Recognize she has a dog in this fight, and she is in a position where impacting the relationship between the client, father, and Dr. Pyburn, that is certainly part of a family law strategy. I want to go back to the core of this, though. There's first of all, if you review the records, Dr. Pyburn fully and accurately documented the child's limited role, that he was a collateral. The parental consent is only required when a child is being treated, and the child was not being treated here. There is no literature, nor there is any law that supports the conclusion, first of all, that collaterals must that a collateral child must have a consent by both parents. But there's also no case law and no law support for the idea that both parents would even have to approve treatment. If the board were to ignore the documentation in this case, it is essentially creating new law and new policy. And I want to get a little more in depth about these records. The records do not, as RC claims, reflect that the child was a client. In fact, the first intake on July 22nd is a five-minute call with Dr. Pyburn and father. It specifically says that she only treats law enforcement and trauma, no children. She specifically wrote that in her phone message to with him, in documenting that call with him. The consent form that father signed, there's two check boxes. One check box is for, are you getting treatment for yourself? The other checkbox is, are you getting treatment for a child and you're signing as the guardian? He checked the checkbox for himself, her father. On the policy form, before father signed, she specifically wrote, father agreed he was client. Child can attend as collateral 1 to 3 times to inform therapist of dad's parenting skills. Father not only signed that form, but he confirmed with Ms. Michelson that, in fact, he did sign that form, seeing that information in there. So there is no situation here where it was not properly documented. Let's move on to the session notes. July 25th, she documented again that she clarified to father, quote, could only be his therapist, not child. She also offered to provide some referrals that treat children if father wanted therapy for that child. In addition, when the question about telling the truth came up, she discussed that with father, not with the child. This case is documented to the hilt with uncontroverted evidence that this child was a collateral and not a patient, and no one has presented any evidence whatsoever that this child received treatment. It's just an assertion by mother here. There's no evidence whatsoever. And keep in mind, the documentation that I've just reviewed with you was all created before any sort of family law dispute occurred that brought Dr. Pyburn into it. So her documentation is occurred contemporaneously with her observations, and it should be taken as accurate. There is just simply nothing here that indicates the failure of documentation. In fact, reading the records, there is a significant number of instances in which we can see the child was not only a collateral, but that was communicated. Turning to the informed consent, Arizona law allows one party to consent to a child's health care. Now, the family court orders have created all sorts of confusion in this area of the law, and I fight this fight in front of every mental health board. But the reality is that the law is the law here. ARS 36501 says informed consent is intelligent consent by the patient or guardian. 36-2272, parental consent for mental health screening. No person may provide a mental health screening, quote, without first obtaining the written or oral consent of a parent or a legal custodian of the minor. Not all, a. Standard 3.10 of the APA, it provides a person who's legally incapable of giving consent, a psychologist must obtain appropriate permission from a legally authorized person, not all. The statutes and the codes here are just unequivocal. One parent consent is what's required. This child was not even receiving treatment, so this really doesn't even apply. But if we apply, if we say for the sake of argument that you apply the same rules to collaterals, one parent needs to give only oral consent here. But the reality is there's no such law for collateral. In addition, the family court order is not relevant here. The family court order gave both parents equal decision-making over health care, but that is not binding on a professional. Dr. Pyburn was not a party to that agreement, and we go down a really dangerous path here if we start saying that health care professionals need to become lawyers and start interpreting family court matters. I would ask you to come up with a time where when you saw your child's dentist or you saw your child's pediatrician,
that they sat down first to review a divorce decree to determine whether or not they could proceed. It is not required by law, and the court does not have the authority to bind Dr. Pyburn. If there is a dispute over a one parent getting care for a child, the remedy is for the parties to go to the family court and have the family court sanction the party that went out of bounds of the agreement. But my hope is that this board does not want to adopt a rule that people who are licensed can be bound by a court order when they have absolutely no involvement in that court order. I would also note that there is absolutely no literature on this topic that says that there needs to be consent for a collateral. Ms. Galvin's counterpart in California, who represents one of the boards, mental health boards, she's written on this topic, and her opinion is that the collaterals, the use of collaterals is within the discretion of the clinician. I would note there is a case out here that takes on a situation like this. The Maine Superior Court said that a social worker who got one party consent, even though a court order required both party consent, was not in violation of the ethical code because the ethical code spoke to getting consent from one parent. The reality is that we can't discipline someone when the law says that it's a one-party consent state or when the law is silent on collaterals, because that creates a due process problem. And then finally, we have this unsafe or unnecessary services issue. Father's interest is wanting to strengthen the relationship with his son. The best way to do that was for Dr. Pyburn to see that relationship, obviously in a microcosm, in a situation where they're playing together. But that was necessary. The APA warns practitioners to not make diagnoses, draw conclusions, or treat without sufficient information. Dr. Pyburn wanted to help this father, and she took the step that was necessary for her to be able to do this the right way. We provided you all the information that allows you to see the documentation, to see the law on the issue of informed consent, to explain why family court orders are not binding on a third-party professional, and we provided you an opinion here. The other thing I would ask the board to think about here is you are making larger policy decisions if we start going down a road where we are making decisions or that are different than what the law says. This parent came to Dr. Pyburn to be proactive. She wanted to learn how to improve his skills. This was father's treatment, and that's important because the board needs to consider, does it want to send a message to fathers or to mothers that they cannot get their own treatment without telling their ex? Because that's what would happen here. It would essentially be a statement that either the father goes and gets treatment without the benefit of the practitioner being able to observe how a father interacts with his child, so they're going to get less than standard care, or you're adopting a rule where a father has to go to his ex-wife and say, I want to work on myself, but and have to tell that spouse, essentially having to make the choice between getting the full amount of care that they deserve or waiving their HIPAA rights, essentially, to tell the other party. It's not what the law requires. The law here does not require consent for collaterals. If it requires consent, or there's a finding here that it requires consent, Arizona law does not require two-party consent, and the documentation in this case is thorough. It mentions the collateral role of this child time and time again. So we are respectfully asking this board to dismiss this complaint. There is no basis in law to support what RC is alleging here.
Ms. Chairman, this is RC. I'd like to just make some clarifications if time permits.
Yes. Okay, we are now with Dr. Pyburn and her attorney. Thank you for those comments. Board members, do you have any questions for the attorney or Dr. Pyburn?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have appointments for the licensee. Or do you have questions, I should say?
Go ahead, Dr. Flowers.
Okay, looking, as I understand it, the father requested services from you. He referred himself. And you did testify at a family court hearing. It sounds as if that was the request of the father, but you were not like a court-appointed expert witness. Is that correct?
That is correct. That's correct.
Okay, and then I'm unclear. You know, there's the father's version of how that interview went. You know, when the son attended the first time. And I'm wondering, did you talk to the son about why he was there and that kind of thing? Or the father apparently said, I'm going to go see a friend and there'll be some toys for you to play with. I wonder if there's anything beyond that told to the son.
I introduced myself as Miss Connie and indicated to the child that I was going to help his dad play better.
Okay.
So he was not told. Hello?
Oh, yes, I'm still here. Just somebody clicked on or off.
So he was not told that I was a counselor or a therapist or that he was pretty much told that I was there to talk to his dad.
Okay.
And that, and members of the board, that is contemplated by the APA. When you are discussing your role, you can vary how you interact with a different person based upon their level of understanding and their ability to understand. And so her saying that she was helping daddy learn to play better, it's an appropriate, it's code switching, essentially, the ability for her to talk to this child and inform him of her role in a way that this child would understand. And there is no prohibition, and in fact, the APA recommends that practitioners engage in code switching when they are interacting with people who may need a different approach to understand how the practitioner participates.
I guess what you're
Dr.
saying
Flowers,
is, yes, I guess what you're saying then is it was given to the child in a form that that Dr. Pyburn felt would be appropriate to his level of understanding.
It was given to the child in the level of his understanding, and certainly in writing on the consent form for father, and then in speaking with father, it was communicated to the guardian as to how that child would be participating as well. So whether you want to approach the consent for collateral such that the board finds one, it was communicated to the guardian properly, and then it was also, through code switching, also done with the child. So in both instances, she accurately established that child as a collateral and established the necessary understanding of the participants.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Flowers, do you have any further questions?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
A few here. On the form, it's the form signed by the father on the 25th of July, 2019. For board members, it's page 64. And in handwriting, it says, father agreed he was the client. Child can be attended as a collateral 1 to 3 times, as to assist the therapist in father's parenting skills. That was already mentioned by you. One thing that it looks as if it's just handwritten in there, and there's a star, and it said father agreed he was client. It just sounds, was that present when the father signed the form?
Yes, I wrote that. We went through the forms before he signed, and I wrote that to be very specific and to give a very clear boundary that the child would not be participating beyond my evaluation period. I didn't want it to fade into something different where it became family therapy or something. So I was very clear, like setting up a boundary at the beginning. And I wrote that in there because I, at the time, did not have a separate collateral form.
Okay, and apparently
I've created a collateral form since then.
Okay, then when a board staff member talked to the father, he agreed he had seen it. And also moving on to, looks like on the 25th of July, for board members, this is on page 66, it was described as an intake. And I'm wondering if a psychological evaluation along with a mental status examination was given, and I also don't see any kind of DSM-5 code given. Can you comment on those issues?
Yes. So I continued the evaluation period for a couple of sessions. I didn't give an evaluation, I didn't give a DSM code immediately because I didn't feel like from the first session I had enough information. So on his treatment plan, once I had enough information, then that's when I wrote up the treatment plan, and the full, or the finishing of the evaluation piece was in October when we've completed the treatment plan, and the diagnosis is on that form on the treatment plan.
And I would note, Dr. Flowers, because this did come up in complaint committee, we specifically, without disclosing in session the diagnosis, we did go back to a few of the SOAP notes and had an exchange with you concerning the diagnosis and the places in the SOAP notes in which the DSM elements of said diagnosis were found. And I just we did have that discussion in detail because you had asked a question, a variation on this question about the ultimate conclusions she reached, and we were able to go back and identify those. And it sounded to Dr. Flowers, to your satisfaction, that you felt that we had demonstrated the DSM elements through those SOAP notes.
Well, there is, again, we can't really state the diagnosis in this public session, but the what was listed for DSM-5 was appeared to be part of a diagnosis, but not the full diagnosis. And, you know, I didn't really see any formal mental status examination, so I don't know if that was done for the father or not.
So the mental status in my paperwork is on the back of the treatment plan, and I thought that was copied for the things that you have.
I don't believe I saw that documentation. I don't know if other board members might have seen that. Okay. And there is some confusion, too, because some of the entries say that AF and son were clients. It's on, looks like it was like on August the 8th, 2019. And also on August 16th, 2019, it says parent-child, but then it also says service, it says parent/child collateral. So, you know, that is not totally clear, you know, when the son is listed as a client. Can you respond to that?
So I guess on my forms, I write, the form says client, and I generally put whoever participated there. But then underneath that, there is the list of how it relates to the treatment plan or who, how people were participating in the session.
Okay.
And so there,
it does say something about collateral.
Yes.
That on the progress note for the 8th of August.
And I would I also encourage the board to look at October 23rd of 2019, where the same phenomenon happens, where he notes she notes the client name, and then she writes plus wife, and next to service type, plus collateral. And so I think the issue is she is calling out the plus person as the collateral. So I think it is documented there.
Okay.
certainly, I think with anything, I mean, I noticed this in my own practice when I go back a year or two to something I wrote to at any of the boards. We can always improve. We can always, you know, renew our forms, things like that. But the question is, does that fall below the standard of care? And there's not a standard of care regarding documentation that would be violated simply because you have to look at a second place to verify or confirm the collateral nature of the other person in the room. So I do think that, you know, certainly we can all continue to refine our processes, but on both the instance where child is present and the instance where wife or girlfriend is present, it is designated as client name plus person, and then it is followed up on service type as therapy plus collateral.
Thank you. Those are one of the questions at this time. I ask other board members if they have any.
Other board members, do you have any questions? All right, hearing none, we appreciate Dr. Byburn and Dr. Meyer. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Byburn. The couple of questions I had refer to the progress note from August 8th. And there you check play therapy as the therapeutic methodology. And you also checked at the bottom of the page that you build as family treatment. So can you explain to me how this was not treatment for the child when you're saying you did play therapy and family therapy?
So I was using play therapy as my theoretical base, and I was teaching father some of the words and the things to look out for in the way that he participated. So specifically looking at attachment as being part of having a really high level of nurture, structure, so I was giving him like play therapy kinds of words and approaching it theoretically from that perspective. The codes at the bottom, I used the one that had there isn't a code specifically for the insurance that says that you have an individual with a collateral in the room. And so I used the one that was defined most closely to who was participating, although it would have been probably more clear to bill it as individual, because I was focusing on the individual. And that's something that that I've looked at since this happened, to be more clear when I send it to the biller. There just isn't a code for the insurance, like I said, that says, you know, who, you know, that kind of covers that you had a collateral present.
I would also note, Dr. Meyer, that the two CPT codes, 846 and 847, are often mismarked, and they do get caught by medical billers a lot, because, you know, 847 can be used for when you are gathering information from family members to support the identified patient. I know it's this does come up where this code is either incorrectly checked or it's up for grabs sometimes, because its companion code is 846, which can be used as services without the patient present. There's still, again, because we're in the area of collaterals where the literature is just not helpful and not really, there's not a significant amount of literature, this issue over the CPT codes does come up. I would ask the board to consider the totality of the documentation, including the specific statements about the child's role to control here. And I think and in addition to father's own statements that the child was not the recipient of any kind of therapeutic treatment.
Thank you.
All right. Are there any further questions?
This is Dr. Gill. I think with respect to checking the box family treatment, it seems to be a reflection of some confusion regarding the treatment plan and whether or not this child is a collateral or not. And that confusion is a concern for me. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, the treatment plan was not completely developed until October. The informed consent was driving the fact that he was a collateral. I really limited his role with that so that it would not become family therapy. And until the treatment plan was completely developed, we did not have complete goals. And it was much more assessment, evaluation of the direction that we were going.
Well, my concern...
Yes, go ahead.
Well, my concern is the confusion issue. What role is this child? You can state that the child is collateral, but it's also inherent in a budding treatment plan. It can be a reflection of a box that's checked, and that it lent itself, at least to me, in reading the documentation, that there is confusion about the role of this 7-year-old, whether he be collateral or not, based upon such simple things as what box you check and stating that he is a collateral, when in fact there are indications that he may have acted in a different role in this therapy, is at least implied here.
I don't, respectfully, Dr. Gill, I don't see that. What I see here is that a child, and I see by father's own testimony to the board, the father indicated the child was brought in, observation was made of them playing together, the child then exited, and any therapy was provided to father. So if we have any kind of confusion over the forms, I think the only true confusion is the checkbox. The reality is what actually occurred here is exactly what Dr. Pyburn and this patient contracted for, which was an informed consent in which 1 to 3 sessions would involve the child as a collateral. That, in fact, came to pass. The child and the father played together. There is no indication, there is no evidence to support a finding that this child received any therapy. And I think we have to go beyond the form with the CPT code checked and look holistically at this file. And this file specifically has the child called out as a collateral. And the testimony provided by the father and by Dr. Pyburn, who did not communicate about about this aspect of this at all. I mean, this is something that father was called up unannounced, and this is the discussion that was had was exactly as Dr. Pyburn indicated in her response. There's no confusion as to the people involved here, which is Dr. Pyburn and the father. A third party, RC, who was not party to this treatment, who did not, to her ex-husband's treatment, I might mention, may have had some confusion, but the reality is what the actual service provided, and this is uncontroverted by father's testimony and by the record, and by Dr. Pyburn's testimony, is that she used that child as a collateral and as a collateral only. And if the board were to go beyond that, though, and say, well, the child was receiving treatment, which I don't think is supported, there's still not a failure of informed consent here because the father was there. And so this is one of those situations where, you know, certainly we can go very granular at these records and pick out an instance where it's not perfect, but the standard of care doesn't really require that. The standard of care requires that things are documented, and she really has documented significantly the collateral nature of this child.
Do you have a comment about mother's question about whether the 7-year-old was able to understand what a collateral is?
Well, first of all, if we treat this child as, first of all, I think Dr. Pyburn in her explanation, which father supports, she properly code switched and used language that is appropriate for his age to establish him as a collateral. Notwithstanding that, APA does allow communication with third parties who can assist a child or a legally incompetent person in understanding their role. And from what we've heard, she effectively did that because she spoke with father about the collateral role. It sounds like on the drive over, father properly relayed that information, and then she used appropriate language with that child. So, first of all, I don't think mother's in a position to take a position of whether the child can or cannot understand his role.
Her position. She's just raising the question.
I think Dr. Pyburn and the father, for that matter, have established that it was done properly. Father was able to communicate effectively the child's role as collateral. Dr. Pyburn identified herself as someone who would be helping father learn to play better. I think that is sufficient for her to establish this child's role as a collateral. And I would further note, there is no law on this topic. There's no law on the topic, and the only literature out there says that it is within the discretion of the practitioner to determine the role of collaterals. And so I think that happened here, and I haven't heard any evidence to the contrary.
There are ethical
that the
principles
didn't understand
that in a treatment plan or a bunning a treatment plan that the role of each individual be clearly defined.
I think
and I'm
telling
just exploring
a
the idea
that
about whether this child understood
Dr. Gill, let me interrupt. We can only ask questions. So if you have a specific question, you can ask that. If it's a discussion you want to have, then that would be when the board actually discusses the issue. Have a specific question? Okay. Are there any other questions for Dr. Pyburn or her attorney?
Yes, Madam Chair, there's another one I have.
Dr. Flowers.
Yes, looking at the documentation, I don't see a treatment plan in October. I see one for August the 16th. For board members, that's on page 77. So was there I think you made mention to a more full treatment plan in October?
We started the treatment plan on the 16th, and then we finished it in October, noting that the father did not come in between. So it was the next session, although it was 2 months later. So the father, we started the treatment plan, and then we ran out of time. And so there are, in October when we met, we finished the treatment plan.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any further questions? Not. Thank you, Dr. Pyburn and your attorney for your participation. The board now is going to deliberate on the case, and I'd just like to, as indicated earlier, the focus of the initial case review is to determine whether there may be violations of state statute or rule. So, Dr. Flowers, would you like to start the deliberation?
Madam Chairman, this is RC, and is there a moment to just clarify some points that Dr. Pyburn's counsel made?
Ms. Galvin, can I just get your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's within your discretion.
All right, thank you. Yes, go ahead, RC.
I just briefly wanted to make just some points of clarification. I understand that Dr. Pyburn's counsel indicated that this is family law strategy. I completely disagree with that. I'm the mother, and my only, and I'm using air quotes here, strategy is to protect my son against an abusive father. I actually take insult to that. Secondly, while counsel states that father was being proactive in trying to help his parenting skills with our son, he was actually being reactive because
This was first brought up to his attention on June 28, 2019, when I filed a police report initially about my son's telling me that his father is abusing him. It was not until October that we were able to get into court for a temporary order hearing. Thirdly, father is not my ex-husband. He is just the father of my child. And counsel stated that it is my opinion, and none of this is my opinion. This all began because Dr. Pyburn stated herself during the October 28, 2019 hearing that she provided advice to my son three times, and that is recorded, and I submitted that to the board for evidence. So it was not based on my opinion. It was based on what Dr. Pyburn stated during the temporary order hearing and family court. Lastly, my son has a dentist. He has an allergy doctor. He has a pediatrician. All three doctors have asked for custody papers or family court papers, and they've made sure that they've been all thorough in ensuring that they understand the law behind my son being treated even for an allergy appointment or a dentist appointment. The pediatrician understands the custody situation, and they've all been proactive about asking who needs consent to treat for my son to be treated. Therefore, I completely disagree that only one parent needs to be in consent. The family law, our decree clearly states that both parents needed to consent to any therapy that my son may be involved in. And again, it is my opinion that he was in therapy per Dr. Pyburn's statement during the October 28, 2019 hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, RC, for those comments. All right. Dr. Flowers, would you please start the deliberation?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the situation, indeed, there are many concerns. Certainly, I understand RC's perspective, trying to take care of her son as best she can. And looking at all this, you know, one thing that I think would be an issue would be the record keeping. I don't really see a lot of clarity within all the documentation about, like, an evaluation process, a mental status examination, a clear diagnostic statement. That concerns me. There is some fuzziness, you might say, in regards to client and all that, but looking at the documentation we have, it does indeed appear that the father was the client. And there are different issues as far as giving statements to collaterals, as far as their role and so on. I don't see a clear violation of that within all of this, even though I understand, again, there's some fuzziness because he was there and at times checked as being a client. But, I think it indeed could be argued that he was there as a collateral, not as the person receiving treatment. But indeed, I would, I guess also as far as the documentation, the handwritten note saying that the father understood that he was the client, not the son, it would have been better had that been like in type print or whatever, and then initialed by the father the date of the other signature. So those are my comments or observations. I invite other board members for theirs.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers. Other board members, your thoughts or comments?
Ms. Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. Yes. Ms. Galvin, can we ask about, can we get legal, not legal advice for us, but just your reaction to the, whether it takes consent from a parent or both parents to receive services?
I would prefer to opine on that in executive session under legal advice. You have been provided material from Mr. Carey. You're free to review that material and assess it on your own. You can also consider what the standard of care is in the community as far as what is required and how practitioners operate when in their own practice when confronted with a situation like this.
Okay, but you would be able to give some information in executive session?
If anyone is seeking legal advice, I can provide that in executive session.
Okay, I would make a motion to go into executive session.
I second the motion.
We have a motion and a second to go into executive session to receive legal advice. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Okay, so what's going to happen is, board members, if you could call the executive session phone number, those that are on the line, please just remain on the line, and we will be coming back on as soon as executive session has been concluded. So, Ms. Poe, is that sound?